Hi there, I'm Eileen Dietz, and you probably know us best from The Exorcist. And Pazuzu and I are here to tell you that we are listening to the Don't Go Out There horror movie podcast. And so should you. Otherwise,
I am Pazuzu, and I am going to come and get you.
In a world where zombies, ghosts, serial killers, and vampires all exist, it's Nico, Brian, Mike, and Dustin, and they are all that stand between you and the films that could end the world. Welcome to the Don't Go Out There Horror Movie Podcast.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Don't Go Out There Horror Movie Podcast. Just want to thank all of our fans and listeners. Really appreciate the support. You guys are awesome. Before we get into tonight's film review, just want to give a quick shout out to our website, don'tgooutthere.com. Everything about our podcast is on the website. All of our episodes and interviews, if you want to check those out. We've done some incredible interviews in the past. Go check them out there in a specific tab by themselves so you don't have to scroll through hundreds of episodes on Apple or Spotify, etc. We also have our store if you want to grab a shirt, a mouse pad, a hat, all that good stuff. We'd love to see your pictures, you know, rep your favorite podcast. And Chan's Etsy page is also attached if you want to grab a Tumblr. All of our social media links are on there as well. Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, TikTok. Like us, subscribe us, follow us, all that good stuff. And the last thing I want to shout out on our website is our Patreon. We call it Blood Donors. We have the traditional monthly reoccurring kind. If you want to support us, help us pay the bills, as we say. Or if there's a movie you want us to review, that option is available as well. Just check out our website, don'tgooutthere.com. Also, if you haven't noticed, we've recently joined the Believe Network. So there's some ads on our program now. But if you want ad-free content, go check us out on Blood Donors. The ad-free episodes will be available there. We appreciate your support. We hope you enjoy the episode. All right, guys, welcome to the film review. It's good to be back. I'm glad you guys held it down last week. Mother Nature let Tallahassee have it, so I missed it. But the trivia was fun. I had a good time listening to it today. I'm actually jealous I didn't get to play that because it seemed really fun. But tonight is my film review. I chose 2024's Late Night with the Devil. Quick thoughts? I fucking love this movie. Brian, go ahead.
Damn, that was quick thoughts. That was quick as shit. All right, so my not so quick thoughts. Let me just say, first of all, that we're definitely venturing into the real world, in my opinion, with these cult reviews this week. I 100% believe in the kind of shit that we recorded in True Detective and everything here with the Grove or the Bohemian Grove in this movie. This stuff may as well be true crime to me. But anyway, first time I watched this, I really liked it a lot. I really appreciate the Carnes brothers for bringing us something new and unique as a movie. While it was still exploring the same stuff that we've seen a ton of times in demonic possession. But now, the subsequent times I've seen this, it does lose a little bit just because I didn't have that anticipation. The ending was a little bit lackluster to me. I wasn't locked in wondering, you know, what was going to happen next, which I've said before happens in a ton of movies, I know. But that first watch, it was really good. I liked it a lot. David Dalmatian is so underrated as an actor. And I think of all of the million things that I've seen him in, I think this may be the first movie with him as the lead that I've seen him in. Mm-hmm. I think this would be a very good Halloween movie to add to the spooky season rotation. And, you know, even on those subsequent viewings, it's still well done enough to hold up, in my opinion, except I'm not a fan of the ending, but we'll get to that.
All right. So I'm in lockstep with Nico on this one. I fucking love this movie, man. Which is surprising to me. Because normally this is not up my wheelhouse. This is not my cup of tea. This possession-style film. But it's done so differently. This is, to me, a very unique take that I, up to this point, had never seen before. I like the talk show aspect of it. I love the characters. And again, sometimes when a movie is shot differently, I feel like it's done just to be artistic and kind of snobby. This one actually has a real reason to be shot like it was in the 70s because the movie fucking takes place on a set in a studio in the 70s. And I think it adds so fucking much, man. love the movie. I do. I think I love the back and forth that we get. Like we're on the show with everybody else. Like we're guests in the audience, and then we can kind of see what's going on behind this, you know, behind the scenes. I love that back and forth. Also, I've seen the ending criticized, and I get it. We'll talk about it when we get there. But for me, it landed because it brought everything full circle from the beginning. I'm not saying it's the best ending of all time. It's not. Don't get me wrong. I wouldn't, you know, rank it up there as the best endings or anything. But I think everything else that came before it was so good and so entertaining to me that it didn't really bug me at all. Love it. Love the performances. I think the effects, even though there's minimal of them, I think the effects look really good. You know, maybe some of the effects were not bad on purpose, but like that's my shitty way of saying it. All in all, man, I was surprised how much I liked the movie, which is probably why my ranking is going to be as high as it is. Because normally any movie with demonic possession kind of is going to automatically be capped at a certain level for me. This one is very, very different, and I'm excited to talk about it.
So I saw this movie in the theater on March 31st, and you know that drawing of the horse where like the first three quarters of it is beautifully drawn with incredible detail, and then the last part looks like a second grader drew it? Like that's how I feel about this movie. I think it had such great potential in the first three quarters of it, but to me, they missed the mark with the ending. Still not a bad movie at all. I think the look of it is great, and it's an original concept, which I, of course, welcome with open arms. Like, I love originality. But I didn't love this one as much as I'd hoped.
We're lockstep for the first time in a long time, I think, there, Dustin. But, Mike, you brought up the effects and how they looked bad on purpose. That's in my notes, but I'll go ahead and touch on it now. Why? Because, I mean, it's not a movie that's made in the 70s with crappy effects. Like, when it shows those effects, it's real world. So they should be, like, look good. It shouldn't look crappy to us. And so that doesn't make any sense to me why they look like 70s effects.
I agree with you in the sense that I would have rather seen better effects, right? I was just giving a reason why I think they chose that artistically. That's really all it was. I think from an artistic standpoint, they thought 70s movie, let's make it look like it's a 70s movie, which I agree with you, though, Brian, like probably would have been a smarter choice to make it look better for a modern audience. But I mean, I think they were like really into the time period.
It's not a 70s movie.
Right.
Like they're not making the effects on the TV show supposed to be real life. So I don't understand. I guess I can't fathom why it looks like that.
Totally.
There's no real world.
Honestly, reason. I just think it was an artistic choice they went with. I'm not necessarily defending it. I was just pointing it out because I have seen that. And I'm like, yeah, no, I agree. The effects aren't great, but I think they went with let's pretend like we shot this movie in the 70s, which I can take or leave the effects argument for sure, but I love the camera aspect and ratio. Like, I love that it looks like we're watching, you know, Johnny Carson from 1970, whatever the fuck. I thought that was cool. But I agree with you. I think the effects probably should have been better.
All right, guys, any more opening thoughts? We just jump into the scene by scene. All right, Lord be with me. I got to read a lot. Hopefully I don't stutter. All right. I think I stole that line from Dustin. I think, hey, Lord bear me strength.
Lord, bear me strength.
You're not going to stutter. You're not me, brother. It's all good.
All right, the films, and there's a lot of dialogue, so I really kind of struggled to give the film justice with scene by scene, but I did my best. The film starts with a TV turning on, and we see chaos from the 70s. We got an energy crisis, serial killers being arrested, articles on the occult, the war. April 4th, 1971, Night Owls with Jack Delroy debuts. Jack jokes to the audience as we see quick montages of segments on the show. November 1972, he inks a 5-year deal, nominated for an Emmy, and has a growing audience. He and his wife Madeline are considered one of Hollywood's happiest couples. He also has support from fellow group members of The Grove, a men's-only group located in the Redwoods of California. It only has rich and powerful men, but speculations of arcane ceremonies follow the group. September 1976, Madeline, a non-smoker, is diagnosed with terminal lung cancer. She appears on Jack's show, and it's his highest-rated episode of Night Owls, but still second to Johnny Carson. 2 weeks later, Madeline dies. Jack shuns the media and flees New York, but 1 month later, he returns to the show. The gap between he and Carson widens. Jack's contract is set to expire, but they are all in on Sweeps Week. This is recently released master tape of the live TV event and behind-the-scenes shots, Late Night with the Devil. Gus intros the guest of tonight's show, and then Jack himself, who doesn't appear at first. Jack sneaks up on Gus in a ghost costume, jump-scaring him. Gus plays the theremin for ambiance until Jack takes over telling jokes. Jack talks about the importance of Sweeps Week, but says the viewer is the most important person to the show. An audience member says she loves him, and Jack gets the show started with their first guest, Christu. All right, Brian, that's the opening set of scenes. What'd you think?
So I love this open with making it feel like we're watching clips of the news on TV. And I think that's brilliant from the Karnes brothers because it really engulfs me. You know, I immediately feel like I'm in the 70s. And despite the common misconception that I was alive in the 70s, I was not. And look, credit to them. Throughout this entire movie, I honestly forget sometimes that I'm not watching a real 70s late night talk show. It's very authentic, and the attention to detail I think is astounding. The Michael Ironside is the one narrating this, and it's his, I think, second appearance on our show after Starship Troopers. Don't go out there.com. But he was great doing that. Something else. I know we mentioned how good Dust Malshian is in this, but the character of Jack and his arc, I think, is very good, too. It's the reverse of what we normally get with the lead, especially. He goes from someone that I immediately like and want success for to someone who, by the end, spoiler alert, you realize sold his soul, literally, and caused this entire thing. Mike, you mentioned the screen ratio. What movie was it that I was talking shit about recently for the screen ratio not being 16:9? Because it didn't make... Okay, that's right, because it didn't make any damn sense to me. But here, it does. I think it's a great choice. And later on, when it changes to 16:9, it makes it that much more effective. And we'll talk about that later. But I feel like I'm at home watching this in 1977 on my TV. The monologue, even, was just such a nice touch. Fantastic starting group of scenes. It didn't take me long at all for this movie to suck me in. And just a quick little fun fact. The ghost of Minnie can actually be seen at several points throughout the movie, almost like The Haunting of Hill House, if you listen to our review, don'tgothere.com, of those. Here at the end of the prologue, around 8 minutes in a TV monitor, you can see the ghost behind Jack when he's leaning on the doorstep, and that's the first time we see her.
Yeah, the first thing I actually noticed is this has like a minute-long intro of the different film companies that had a hand in this. Like, it took forever. I honestly thought it was a gag. I'm not going to lie. I was like, how many fucking people work on this? I almost love anything that has to deal with that mid to late 70s era of film. Like, just so, like you mentioned, Brian, this news clip made me feel like I was watching news from the 70s on my couch. Like anybody in the 70s would have. They did a great job, man, splicing these things together like this. And I just love that we get an introduction to what feels like would have been a real night show at that time, the Night Owls with Jack. Like, I really and I love how they kind of go over the backstory of his rise to fame and how, you know, it's kind of petering out a little bit, which, by the way, Madeline Piper, call me sometime. Anyway, the minute they said the Grove or started going over that, I'm like, this is a Bohemian Grove reference. This movie is going to be up my fucking alley, brother. I can't wait. And again, setting this up like it was a late night TV special or like they were doing a news story on what happened during this episode of this late night talk show, I thought was brilliant. It felt real. It felt like a documentary of sorts. Like there's a narrator involved. Like it's really nice touches and real good attention to detail, like you mentioned. The fact that this feels like a real late night talk show from the time period. The monologue really sealed the deal for me. Like it just felt like something that Carson would do. Like you watch an old clip of Carson or one of the ones from the 90s even. Or this just feels like almost like a Leno-esque monologue where he's talking about Jackie Robinson, talking about Jimmy Carter. Like really, really felt of its time. It made me more immersive in that era while watching it. And last thing I thought that was a really nice touch is not often do these late night shows acknowledge ratings on the actual broadcast. That's kind of a no-no in TV, but I felt like it was almost realistic of them for Jack to acknowledge it here after we got his backstory. So I loved it. This opening really, really sucked me in and got me invested right away.
So like I mentioned, I love the look of the movie. Everything is perfect from that aspect. And it's that way from the jump. It looks and feels like it took place in the 70s. I love the TV montage of happenings around the world to set the scene for the period. I also love the introduction to Night Owls and how they bring us up to speed with the show and on Jack. Very effective usage of a narrator. So something that I was critical of the movie when we did our instant reaction was how Lily mentioned later in the movie meeting Jack before in the trees. And on a second watch, I get that now. So I was a little late getting into the theater when I watched this the first time because I did a double feature that day. Before this movie, I saw Sydney Sweeney's Immaculate, and it ran a little bit longer than it should have. So I missed the whole mention of the men's club. I got in there right after that. So it makes so much more sense to me on my second watch, and I take back that portion of my criticism. But anyway, unrelated to the review, but I've said this before and I'll say it again. Anytime I ever hear someone say Sweeps Week, I think of the classic movie Money Talks with Chris Tucker and Charlie Sheen. Fuck a Sweeps Week. Anyway, 10 out of 10 title card here. Great usage. It looks like the title show to the show. And we get a great ad, or we get an ad that looks perfect for the era. I just love this intro. It's just elite stuff. I love the chemistry with Jack and Gus. These two both kill it in their roles. Dasmalchian seems so natural as a talk show host, and Gus, he seems very natural as a sidekick, kind of like Andy Richter is to Conan O'Brien. It's a very solid open that it has my undivided attention.
All right, the crowd claps for Christu and the men shake hands. Christu confirms on All Hallows Eve the deceased content to unfinished business. He says he can switch off the voices in his head like a radio. Christu begins his crowd work saying he's receiving signals. The letter P, Peter, Pete, Peterson. A man from the crowd says Peterman. Wife's maiden name was Peterman. Barry, however, says his wife ran off 5 years ago and cracked some good jokes. The spirit passes and Christu moves on to a mother and daughter while Jack jokes with an audience member on their costume. He talks to the ladies about Edmund, their brother and son. We find out Edmund committed suicide 5 years ago. He left no note. He tells them Eddie is at peace and he hears the word Papa. That was his Teddy's name. The mother tells Edmund that Papa is safe. He thanks them and walks away, blessing the crowd. They show the tour dates until Christu begins to be taken over by an intense spirit screaming. He gets the name Minnie and asks for someone to accept. Christu's eyes roll in his head, seeing an unmarried man wearing a wedding ring. The lights go out and the spirit is gone. Commercial break and the crowd is in a bit of a shock. They check on Christu as Gus asks about some unplanned events with the girl once she gets on stage. Jack and Leo get a drink as Jack is told the vice president of marketing is in the crowd. Jack asks about June making it safe and goes back to his chair. Christu snaps on the makeup lady and the show goes back on air. Jack intros Carmichael Haig, former conjurer, now leader of the Skeptics movement. He sits down and does some magic tricks with a cigar. Haig is known for Vegas shows, group hypnosis, but now works with IFSIP, the International Federation of Scientific Investigation into the Paranormal. Haig tests claims to see if they're genuine or not. Haig thinks the world will be better off with these phenomenons, but needs irrefutable proof. He's yet to give away a nickel of his own money. Christu begins to cough violently, and Haig explains his readings. Christu snaps and throws water in his face, storming away. Jack confesses the last reading may have been meant for him. His wife Madeline's private name was Minnie. He shows his wedding ring, and Haig is disgusted. Christu falls over and throws up black liquid on Haig, and they cut to commercial. All right, Brian, next set of scenes, what'd you think?
So, Fayasal Bazzi, I think, does a great job as Christu. It's very obvious he's a hack, using all the typical tricks of the trade. There's another instance of Ghost Minnie as well here when Christu is talking to who we found out later is staged mother and daughter. She appears just at a brief glance near Jack after audio glitch before Christu's real meltdown, which, again, I did say the movie wasn't as good in subsequent viewings to me, but to be fair, it does take those subsequent viewings to pick up on stuff like this, because when you're watching it the first time, you're like, what is real? What is staged? We get another brief Ghost Minnie instance here as well around the 24-25 minute mark in a mirror backstage just as the crew is about to go back on the air. And again, in Carmichael's pocket watch as it sits on the table, which brings me to Carmichael, played by an almost unrecognizable Ian Bliss, who is Bane from The Matrix 2 and 3 and Superman Returns. Super underrated. That's not, I didn't even mean that, but yeah, super underrated. Very clearly based on the real life James Randi. I said unrecognizable because, I mean, they even have Bliss look like Randi. If you don't know who Randi was, he's basically this dude, real life magician who became a famous psychic debunker and offered a large reward to anyone who could reproduce their powers. Nobody ever won the money, and Randi actually died in 2020. Anyway, frequent guest on Carson, too. So there you go. Again, everything in this is just, it's so close to real life that things are embedded in our pop culture that it just, it adds to the realism to me because it's just different enough that it feels like you're watching something historical. And did anyone else catch the Burt Reynolds reference with the even Carmichael saying that he's no believable than he himself looking like Burt Reynolds? And then Christu hitting him in the water with the water in the face, just like when Burt Reynolds threw water on Mark Summers on Leno's show. I didn't see anywhere where that was a real reference, but I don't know, surely it had to be. I don't know, just being a Burt Reynolds guy, I noticed it. It was too on the nose there, I think, for it to be real. But another great group of scenes, and really the start here where it begins to let me know that this whole thing is really going to be about Minnie and Jack and not necessarily about the possessed girl that we're, you know, led to believe from the trailers.
Yeah, I mean, we start with Christo here. And all I can think of, and I know I'm not the only one that saw this movie and thought of it, this is literally straight out of the South Park episode on John Edwards, where they like where Stan goes and shows everyone how these TV psychics, you know, do it. They start very general and random, and you know, he even gets it wrong with the guy in the audience. I just think it's such a nice touch because we kind of know the jig now, like it's in the pop culture consciousness, like you said, Brian. With these TV psychics, some people still believe, some people don't. It's very kind of a divisive line. And I think they do a good job kind of playing on that where they show an example of both in this audience. And then we get what is basically a James Randi clone, right? Like, and by the way, I don't know if I've ever revealed this, but I like the work of James Randi because I also don't believe in any of this. And if you do, that's great. Congratulations to you. But I typically, when he wasn't being a smug prick, I was in support of James Randi. I feel like he came off a little aggressive, and so does Carmichael here. But again, and they show the reason I hate these kinds of people, right? Like why I don't like these kinds of people, like Christo, because he gets it wrong. And he's like, no, sorry, my wires were getting crossed, and then starts doing random shit again, and then just so happens to find someone in the audience. Who we find out later that was staged by them, right? So, and I just think it's a perfect place. And I'm not the moral police. Make your money how you're going to make your money. I just don't like these faux people, man. They don't do anything for me. And, you know, to kind of touch on the behind-the-scenes stuff I mentioned in my open, we're almost seeing two movies at once a little bit here because we're locked in and sucked in to the talk show aspect. I love this thing where they keep cutting to commercial and then you see almost a completely different movie. It's shot differently. It looks different. There's some black and white in there. Like, I think they do a really good job of like having the difference between the two. And I think it's interesting that it grounds the movie some in reality when we're talking about ratings, getting viewership, getting callers to call in, you know, TV executives, all that stuff. We're talking about, you know, spiritual stuff, possession, stuff like that. And this kind of just grounds the movie a little bit for me. I'm a fan. And look, again, the movie flips right here because it's been calm. You know, there's been some back and forth between Carmichael and Christo or whoever. But this is where the movie kind of flips and we start to see some stuff with this black goo, which I know, Dustin, I hope anyway, I'm praying that you thought of black goo with Papa Shango and the Ultimate Warrior, because that's what I fucking thought of, brother, was that black goo that Vince McMahon thought was the funniest thing he'd ever seen. And when Christo threw up, I was like, Vince, fuck Vince McMahon forever. But he probably would have died laughing at that scene. Sorry, go ahead.
He'd have laughed even more if it was poop. Vince McMahon loves poop jokes. Very dramatic performance from Christo. It's very typical for what we see of TV psychics. And yeah, Mike, I also... It was just like the episode of South Park where they make fun of John Edward, just saying vague statements, and eventually someone will relate in pure coincidence. when Christo starts freaking out, I thought it was a great touch to have him lose the accent. I don't know if that was touched on by you guys, but it's a great way to show
that's
that
a great
this
point.
Like this great is real. Point. This is not part of his act. His accent completely changed. Another thing I think was a great touch was how the cameras went monochrome during commercial breaks. I love that they kept that throughout the movie to show us, you know, when they're on air and the difference and whatnot. I thought that was awesome. Carmichael's such a pretentious douchebag, man. Like, what a dick. I do like him mentioning Ed and Lorraine Warren, though. Like, it, you know, circles back in, ties into real life things that were happening at the time. Great revelation when Jack and Christo's last reading was when he said that his last reading was for him. I thought that was a good, like, not really oh shit moment, but just, you know, layers the situation more. Right before Christo puked, his stomach sounded like Timberland's in a dryer. Jesus Christ, man. That's what I sounded like that night. After
Jesus Christ.
That's what I sounded like that night after I ate that 50-piece spicy nugget from Wendy's. Do not do that. I didn't projectile vomit, but, you know, it was rough enough, luckily. Luckily, I didn't puke. But anyway, it's another decent set of scenes here.
I just want to be clear. I don't support how the Carmichael character comes off. The same way I don't love the way that James Randi spoke to people. I typically agree with what they're saying, not how they're saying it. I feel like they're both kind of smug, pretentious douchebags with no openness to at least consider the other side. They think they know everything. They're not even leaving any room for doubt. And I don't like that part of their character. Just wanted to point out I'm not some Carmichael stand up here. He's an asshole for sure.
And I'm sorry to our listeners, like half of us are pronouncing it Christo, half of us are pronouncing it Christo. I think we're having a little bit of an argument off air a little bit about it. I'm not real sure which way to go with that. Is it Christo or Christo? I'm not sure.
So, I took it as Christo because I think
Christo is how they said it in the movie now.
Yeah, it was Christo because I remember looking up the credits and thinking Christo, but because of how it's spelled, but yeah.
I mean, I watched this movie earlier, and they were saying it Chris do. I mean, but, you know, pronounce it however you want to. It, like, who gives a shit?
I thought you call him old Chris C. Money.
I thought he was saying Chris Stone.
I'm just going to call him that dead guy here in a little bit. Spoiler.
Listen, his mama calls Clay, Mike. I'm going to call him Clay.
Oh, my bad, bro.
All right, Chris do yells, something's not right, and they get him to his dressing room. Haig sends for his other coat as Haig calls out Jack for the last reading. He asks to be taken to the Grove to see if all the rumors are true, especially the orgies. Show goes back on air, and Jack tells the audience Christo is receiving medical attention backstage. Magic trick with a check in Jack's coat pocket, and we hear an ambulance speed away. Jack tells the crowd of the book, Conversations with the Devil. Jack has him play a video June's team made, the headquarters of the First Church of Abraxas. Xander Diabo says Abraxas shows him there's no good, no evil, no redemption, only what we desire and how we obtain it. The FBI is onto the cult of children being bred for sacrifice. Anyone who witnesses these rituals will fall upon the spell of Abraxas and so perform his earthly bidding. August of 74, things turn when federal agencies lay siege on the house. The cult douses themselves in gasoline, but a 10-year-old girl named Lily survives. We hear a recording of June with Lily performing her encounters with the demon in Lily. The two are welcomed to the stage, and Lily awkwardly prances out. She's awkward on stage as well, and Jack asks if she's seen the show. Lily says June thinks he's handsome and talks about his wife and losing people. Lily says not to worry about his TV show. He's going to be famous very soon. We go to commercial as Lily continues her death stare into the camera. Jack says Lily is adorable, and Minnie's voice takes over, asking Jack, don't I always look pretty? June pulls Jack to the side and says she doesn't think they should do this. She's getting more unpredictable. Yesterday she was saying your name, like she was recalling your name. It was very strange, even for her. Jack reassures her she's not going to back out now. Leo tells Jack Christo is dead. He hemorrhages in the ambulance. Jack says it can't get out, especially to Gus. Haig is asking the women from earlier questions and finds out about them being questioned before the show. He thanks them and returns to his chair. Lily asks if everything is okay, Jack, and the show goes back on air. All right, Brian, the next set of scenes, what'd you think?
So at the start of this, Jack's sitting in the wrong chair right before they go back on air. I don't know if that's a goof that they just left in or if that was in the script, but I'm really glad that they did it. It's a small thing, just a really small thing that adds to the realism, in my opinion. And something else I meant to bring up earlier, another choice I really liked from Cameron and Colin was the choice of having the behind the scenes stuff be black and white, or at least desaturated. I don't think it's 100% black and white. Maybe I'm wrong there, but the visual choice that separated you from when you were in color on air, you know, and both of that being in that old 4-3 ratio, I really liked it. Now, here in this group of scenes, I'm conflicted. Like, it delves into probably the first thing that I didn't care for, which is the Church of Abraxas stuff. Like, did we need that stuff? I mean, I guess it does give the backstory of Lily, which I don't think as a moviegoer that we needed. But I do admit that if this was a real life late night talk show, it would definitely be on there. So I don't know. I mean, from a movie standpoint, maybe making the girl a little bit more of a mystery and just having that tape conversation from July 10th, which admittedly was very fucking creepy. But I didn't need the Abraxas video from a movie standpoint. But would I have needed it on a TV standpoint? I don't know, but I would have gotten it. So I understand the choice. Ingrid Torelli, just bravo, though, as Lily. I mean, I would love to have her on the show soon, trying to make that happen. But the way she acts as Lily is the creepy part to me. Like, Ingrid does such a good job. Laura Gordon as well does such a good job working off the small Sheehan and letting us know that there is definitely something going on between the two of them. And Gordon, who played Ashley in Saw 5, isn't she the one who got her head chopped off? Like, I'm not the Saw specialist here, so tell me if I'm wrong. But I thought, okay, all right. I'm getting thumbs up there by our director. So,
Oh, it's me. Sorry. Okay. Again, you know, we get these cuts to commercial where they're talking about ratings, ratings, ratings. Man, if I'm this guy, see, it. Again, anything for ratings is great, but this is where we kind of start to see just a little bit of a turn of the character of Jack. Like, some of the clips and trailer gave it away just a smidge of, like, where that character could go. But I do think up to this point, we like Jack. We feel bad for him. This is kind of a little bit of a turning point here where he's kind of fine with whatever will get the best rating, which, okay. And again, it's a slow turn. But see, Brian, I understand what you're saying, but this promo package leading into Lily and June being on the show really nailed it for me. And I don't know exactly why. Maybe I hate to keep referencing wrestling on this show, but there really is a lot of crossover here, man, okay? This felt like a good WWE hype video for a WrestleMania match. Like, just the setup, they gave you everything, like, everything you needed to know to bring them on to the stage without having to do a whole bunch of research. Everything's in this little TV package, and I viewed it like we were watching something about this set in the 70s. And so I felt like it was needed, I felt like it was necessary, and I felt like it made it a whole lot creepier. And this church kind of ties in to the ending of the film, in my opinion. So at least there's some ties there. I was a fan. It kind of touches a little bit on that late 70s to early mid 80s satanic panic stuff too that was going on at the time. So there's a little bit of that. And June and Lily are what I most saw out of the trailers and clips before I actually saw the film. So I was very interested once I saw the film to see if that was going to be as scary as it looked. And again, y'all know this isn't really something that normally creeps me out, but boy, it worked here. I love these two. And you know, kind of Jack treating Lily as a child and her coming back at him with a more mature adult way of saying things and her facial expressions, I thought it was so fucking creepy and so well done. Ingrid, as you mentioned, just captivating. The minute she's on screen, she steals the show. She takes over the movie with her performance, and it starts right here. And I know there's memes and criticisms of her looking into the camera, but like, they even made it a part of her character. Like, she's never been on TV before, so she's trying to look at the camera because that's what you think you're supposed to do. So I think it works. Like, I know people are like, creepy face into the camera. We've seen that before, but in the context of the film, God, I think it worked so well because, again, she doesn't know what she's supposed to do with her hands like Ricky Bobby. So same thing to me. And again, I do like that in these cutting to commercial things, we get a little bit more June and Jack backstory. There's something there with those two already that I wasn't. And to find out Christo was dead. I fully expected him to come back into play. So I thought that was interesting as well. Really liked the set of scenes because, to me, this is where we start to get into the meat and potatoes of the film for sure.
Yeah, yelling something's not right is also what I sounded like after eating that 50-piece. But anyway, Carmichael bringing up the Grove to Jack was lost on me the first time I watched it because I missed that part in the open. But I do like that here. It's a great way to keep that part in the forefront of our minds. I like the clip to bring us up to speed with Lily's story. I thought the inclusion of everything was well done. There's something so unsettling with Lily. Like, she's got this empty gaze and fake tone that just gives me the heebie-jeebies. So phenomenal acting by her. Super creepy when she asked Jack, "Don't I always look pretty?" When the makeup person came over to her, I thought that was a good touch. Jack should have listened to June here. Heed her warning, bro. Trust me. Trust me. Christo dying was a crazy revelation, but in hindsight, it didn't make any sense to me. He had no interaction with Lily, so I don't know why he had to die. Like, it seems like a pointless side note in the story to me. Maybe I'm alone in that, but other than that, it's a good set of scenes.
All right, Jack begins talking to June about being a parapsychologist, and Haig interrupts her repeatedly. She speaks on events that she doesn't believe traditional science can monitor, like telepathy, telekinesis, demonic possessions. June believes Lily is possessed by a more minor deity that served Abraxas. Haig fakes like the dagger is trying to take him over and stab him. He mocks the crowd, calling them a suggestible lot. Haig says Abraxas' name is the source of a magician's favorite incantation. Abracadabra, Lily says. She tells Jack she calls the demon Mr. Wriggles because it wriggles its way in and out of her head. The eerie music plays and Gus tries to stop it, but the machine zaps him. Lights and glass begin to bust until Haig unplugs the backfeed. Lily says it's Mr. Wriggles. She asks Haig why he's so condescending. Jack asks if it's okay to invite Mr. Wriggles on the show. Lily begs June to bring him on the show. The people have spoken. June agrees if she gets full cooperation, she will do a brief demonstration. Jack says they will try and commute with the devil, but not before a word with our sponsors. June is furious at Jack calling him a terrible listener. Gus asks to speak to Jack. He says he's meddling with things he doesn't understand. Jack tells him he's trying to save the show. He knows about Christy and thinks Mr. Wriggles is behind it all. He and others are thinking of jumping ship. Show is back on air, and Jack lets June take over with the demonstration, wishing them Godspeed. She starts the ritual, asking Lily to close her eyes and sleep. June asks to speak to Mr. Wriggles. Lily begins to twitch violently, and they calm the crowd. Lily laughs and reveals her demonic face. She questions who these people are and where is she. Lily speaks on her purpose. She says, "Good to see you again, Jack. We go way back. We met amongst the tall trees, remember?" She mocks June, saying his last sword died an ugly death. She sings Jack and June went up the hill to fuck each other's brains out. June smacks Lily and she goes back to normal. Psych. She jump scares June and laughs at her for her prayers and recites them. Lily's chair begins to levitate after she asks Jack, "How could you let it happen?" And a beam of energy circles the roof. Lily apologizes and June does as well. Jack sends him to commercial after Haig says he would like to point out a number of tricks portrayed by the doctor. All right, Bryson, next set of scenes, what'd you think?
Hey, Dustin, what you were talking about last set of scenes with Christou's death kind of being a pointless side note and not interacting with Lily, I get that. I didn't really think about that, but I guess the way I took it is that this demon is fucking with everything and everybody. I think it comes up in the next set of scenes too, where I was like, oh, okay, so the demon's fucking with that too, even though they're not interacting with Lily. So
That's fair. It's just, to me, he was the only one that died, like, that was pure consequential, like, that didn't have any interaction with Lily. So that was my gripe with it.
I gotcha. You know, something else that was a nice touch, you know, as we begin to unravel what's really happening with this demon here. You know, traditional folklore states that if a person makes contract with the devil for earthly goods, the devil comes to claim his payment via one of his servants or himself within 7 years. And the documentary footage at the start of this movie shows Delroy at the Grove in 1969. I mean, isn't that where the US of A walked on the moon that year, Dustin?
That actually never happened, so.
I wanted to get you riled up. Am I going to community noted on that one? His wife actually dies in 1976, 7 years later. Now, this torment here just kind of shows you why you don't fuck with this kind of stuff. And, you know, I talked about the realism. I'll say it again. You know, I believe in all this stuff. I believe in a lot of the elite in this world having sold their souls. And I've said on here, I believe in demons and all of this. So I do have to ask myself, why did this not scare me? Like, I don't have an answer for that, except to say, you know, nothing about this movie really scared me, which, given the subject matter, honestly came as a surprise to me. I mean, maybe that says something about the movie. Maybe it says something about me. I don't know. I just work here. Now, when the demon is speaking through Lily, I'm not sure how much of her face changing was CGI, how much of it was makeup or the mixture of the two, but I thought it was very effective, and I couldn't find anything about that on IMDb or anywhere else. But I like that it didn't go full Reagan possession look. So Greg Cooper, Peter Leary, Dylan Perry, and the whole visual effects team, as well as the entire makeup department, I thought just bravo. It was such a damn good scene. And Ingrid was just, she's absolutely fucking killed it. The demon copying June's attempt at an exorcism, or I guess prayers, that was crazy. Like, I loved that. Nitpick, though, I didn't care for the electricity or the chair levitation. Like, that's where it came across a little bit hokey. And again, we kind of get into the effects talk that we were talking about earlier as well, and how that doesn't really make any logical sense to me. But go ahead.
Again, fair, for sure. Look, I agree with Haig on a lot of shit, but like I've already said, he's just a fucking prick, so it's really hard. Like, it's not a likable character. Smug, arrogant. So again, even though sometimes I'm like, man, I wanna be with you here, but you're coming off like a total asshole. And so it even made me second guess my own thoughts and beliefs. Like, maybe I shouldn't be siding with this motherfucker because he sucks. Totally get it. And again, I think it's creepy to name a demon Mr. Wriggles. That's super fucking creepy there. And I do think it was the perfect timing from a, you know, like how they shot the movie standpoint, where all this noise and stuff started to break the feedback and everything too. I will say, it is such a subtle thing, but June looked absolutely terrified to participate in this exorcism thing that she was about to do with Lily. Like, and it showed on her face during the, you know, while the cameras were rolling, when Jack was asking her, like, it was very subtle, but it was noticeable for me. And I just thought it was such a great little piece of acting there, for sure. Again, we're starting to get less and less into the cutting to commercial breaks, which I think is a good thing. It's getting shorter. It may ground it in realism, but now it's kind of time to get to the heavy stuff, and I'm ready. This is some crazy shit here, man. this is incredible. I love everything about this exorcism scene. I think not often does shit like this scare me and freak me out, but this one did. And I think it's a performance of Ingrid as Lily, who just knocks it out of the park. She does a great job, and it was so effective. And we touch a little bit more on Jack being a, not Satanist, I guess, but like selling his soul, like Brian mentioned, the lead in this world and what they do. And they're likely starting to touch on that again here, which is tying back to the very beginning of the film and the rumors around Jack. And I think that just plays on Hollywood and all the rumors that people have about Hollywood and the people in Washington and all this stuff. They do a really good job kind of layering that in slowly here, in my opinion. I just loved everything about it. I love, even the chair levitating was a little hokey, but I think, you know, almost every possession movie we see has some form of that. And so I think you had to have it a little bit here. And I think it was really well done. And plus, it kind of plays into the next set of scenes where Carmichael tries to prove them wrong, so to speak.
Those aren't rumors, Mike. Those are all substantiated claims. They're all devil worshipers.
Well, first of all, I was talking about Jack and the rumors about him. Real life, hey, yeah, man, go nuts. Sure, why not?
Carmichael's such a dickhead, man. Like, grabbing the dagger and putting on that show, that was such a prick move, man. But an even bigger dickhead move by Jack to put June on the spot and ask Lily if he could bring Mr. Wriggles on the show. She either gives in and puts Lily at risk, or she looks like the bad guy. It's a real lose-lose for her. What a dick. Gus is just like me, for real. I wouldn't be down with this, man. But I am a little bit different than him. I'd leave straight up. Fuck this job. No job is worth me, you know, being in the same studio as the devil. I like how the return from commercial break this time doesn't have any music. The silence is perfect. Like, it's very somber and eerie. So I thought that was a good touch. Very tense when Lily goes to sleep and it seems like nothing is happening. But then Mr. Wriggle starts going crazy in the chair. Great job on the voice and makeup effects on Lily here. Just elite stuff all around. Mr. Wriggle saying they met Jack among the tall trees. It made so much more sense to me on the second watch. And honestly, it is a great touch. I really liked it. Just a lot of great stuff here in general, but also some of the stuff that misses for me. Like the electricity being visible running along the wiring on the ceiling. Like, I don't know. That was just a miss. It was unneeded. The levitating chair was a hit. I did like that. As was Lily's face going back to normal after the chair lands. Like, great effects. It's just that's crazy. Overall, it's a pretty solid set of scenes.
All right, the citizens shock and Haig questions if this is a talk show or a freak show. Jack pulls June to the side, saying, "That was amazing. Glad to get you back on as soon as possible to be a regular segment." She questions what happened in the tall trees. Jack cuts Lily out the restraints as Gus calls out Leo, but quickly folds under Leo's pressure. Gus tells Haig Christu died puking his guts out to cyanide. Leo shares the good news to Jack that they want an emergency 7 a.m. meeting. Jack celebrates being back, the resurrection of Jack Delroy. Jack fears the end of Lily's segment sounded like Minnie's voice. Shows back on air and apologizes to anyone upset or offended by Lily's possession. Lily assures to everyone she's fine and explains what she just went through, apologizing if Wriggles said anything rude. Haig questions if she's sane, and June takes offense, saying she and Lily are family. Jack calls Haig self-righteous, trying to weasel out of paying the money. Haig volunteers Gus for the demonstration. Gus says his wife likes his head on his shoulders and not to have it spin. The lights dim and smoke fills the room. Haig asks Gus if he's comfortable and uses his pocket watch to put Gus and the audience in a nice, relaxed state. He asks Gus about his fear of worms. Haig says he's now deep in a trance. He snaps his fingers and says he's entirely under his command. Gus hears moaning and says it's hot, removing his jacket and unbuttoning his shirt. Haig says his neck is bleeding. Gus pulls worms out of his neck and panics. "I can feel them inside me," and he rips his stomach open, spilling worms everywhere. Haig snaps his fingers, but nothing happens. Lily laughs at Gus acting silly as a giant worm pops out of Gus's eye. Haig awakes Gus and nothing's happened. Jack says there were worms all over Gus and asks Haig what just happened. He says he did the same thing as June and may still be the best in the game. Jack wants Leo and the crew to play back the tape. Upon a rewatch, it's nothing like the crowd just witnessed. Haig manipulated Gus the entire time. Jack stops the tape and Gus says he's never been so embarrassed. Jack admits Haig got them all and Haig calls out June. Lily suggests they look back on Lily's segment of the show if Haig doesn't think the camera lies. Jack suggests they reschedule Cleo so they can rewatch the tape. Lily stops June from leaving and says we're staying. All right, Bryce, next set of scenes, what'd you think? And the next set is the end.
Okay, so I have to ask, though, and this may be an interactive part of the program here, but with everything coming out in the open, like the demon basically calling Jack out for them having, you know, met amongst the tall trees, last set of scenes, and him definitely being the reason why his wife was killed. So obviously Jack doesn't think that that was a coincidence, and he knows that his wife was the price that he had to pay, or does he think that's just a coincidence? Because all this stuff being aired, I mean, you would think, or at least I would, that Jack would want to stop this whole thing and not proceed with it, right? Or is it just the idea of basically he's finally getting everything he wants publicity-wise by his selling his soul coming out in the open? Or
I've taken this as he sold his soul, obviously, being in that group, witnessing the arcane things with the Abraxas and all that. But I don't think he knew that they were going to take many. I don't think he knew that.
Yeah.
Does he know now that that was because of him selling his soul, or does he think that was a coincidence, dude?
No, I think he knows by the end.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think he starts putting the pieces of the puzzle together as more and more happens on the show.
Okay, so but right now he doesn't think that.
No.
Right? Like, okay.
At this point in the film, he doesn't.
Okay, well, that makes sense. Okay. All right. So where was I? Shout out to Reese Atari. The guy who plays Gus also played Mario on the Super Mario Brothers. Nah, I'm just fucking joking. But it's a him. It's Mario. I mean, it kind of looks like him. No? Okay.
Yeah, there's some similarities there.
Honestly, I don't know how I feel about the possession thing, though, with him. Like, I know it's supposed to be like we're hypnotized to and seeing this as well. the thing, this is what I was talking about earlier. Is it the demon playing tricks on everyone and what we're all seeing? It's just Carmichael taking credit for its working? Because, I mean, he sure acted like when he was snapping and Gus wasn't coming out of it, that it wasn't working. So, I don't know. I mean, was the demon playing into that? That's how I took it, was like Carmichael just kind of took credit for it after he finally came out of it. But that was the demon's doing, not his.
I think Carmichael was being a showman that whole time, personally.
So how do you explain everybody seeing what we saw?
I think he hypnotized them.
So, okay. So when you say showman, you meant like legitimately, like he was.
Yeah, I mean, I think even like the snapping thing, like faking like he couldn't stop him, I think he was faking all that too.
Me too.
I think he was just being a showman.
I had that in my notes. I think that was all BS.
Okay. All right. Okay. Yeah. See, when he took that, I thought like he was losing control. He looked a little worried and the demon was the one doing this. Okay. Gotcha. Gotcha.
Anyway, former magician. So I think he was showing off.
Makes sense. Okay. Okay. Yeah. Gotcha. Gotcha. All right. So sorry about that. That whole set of scenes, my review was basically me asking questions, but go ahead.
No, because I have that in my notes here. I'm like, he's definitely faking the fact that he can't stop it. Like he tries to act like, oh no, I'm losing to this demon. It was all bullshit. All show. Turns out not bullshit, but he thought it was. Again, I mentioned it in my last set of scenes, but I think right here we really start to see it. How we started, started out the movie liking Jack and slowly turning on him as a viewer. Like some of these pictures and clips I've seen kind of gave it away. I mentioned it, but I just think the turn of the character being more about the ratings, more about whatever can get him to the top, is very clear as the movie progresses. And again, I kind of started to grow a little bit annoyed with these custom commercials. I like them, but like how, but as I mentioned, they kind of start to reveal who Jack really is. So it works. This movie feels like a really personal attack on James Randi for sure, especially in this set of scenes here, because while he may have been smug, this felt like a very big fuck you to him and all the people that support him, in my opinion. There's nothing wrong with that. Hey, go ahead. I understand. I do like this scene with Hague and Gus, though, man. Because it looks like the movie kind of doesn't want to pick a side, and then we're hypnotized. There's fucking nasty-ass worms everywhere coming out of Gus. And we saw it, but it wasn't real. We were all hypnotized, so to speak. And I love that because I do think, like we've already touched on, that was all a show from Carmichael. Like, I absolutely, totally believe he was just fucking with people. When he acted like he was about to lose control of it, that was all bullshit. None of it was real. And he pulled one over on everybody. And like, Judy even says, he played a mean trick on us, which is true. He did play a mean trick on them. A former magician who thinks everybody up on the stage is full of shit. Yeah, he pulled a little bit of a trick. And I just love that that's the character development that we got there. He flipped it on the audience, and I just loved the back and forth. I thought it was brilliant shit. Go ahead, Dustin.
Yeah, Jack being selfish is very typical of someone who's starving for fame. All he cares about is his ratings, so I thought they nailed that. I don't know why Gus is still around. He should have left a long time ago. No job is worth yucking it up with the devil. Nope.
He ain't never lied.
Fuck no. The night Jack Delroy interviewed the cock-fucking devil. What a wordsmith. I don't think I've ever heard the term cock-fucking before, but adding it to the repertoire. The whole scene with Carmichael and Gus was a mind fuck the first time I saw it. Tremendous work by the whole crew for that. Great effects and a brilliant idea to throw us off. I mean, a hypnosis idea executed like that. This is fantastic. Him ripping his guts open and the worms falling out was disgusting, and Lily laughed while everyone else was freaking out. That was a great touch. Great job by her. And then a great idea from Lily to request VAR. Our soccer fans will get that for her performance. That'll shut Carmichael up. I thought that was good. It's like, well, the tape won't lie. Run the tape back and watch what I did. So that was good. But yeah, the movie hasn't fallen apart for me yet. So I really like this set of scenes too.
All right, here's the ending. Jack has him start the tape of Lily in June. Hague says he wants to examine the tapes. The tape glitches and Jack asks him to go frame by frame after seeing something. The ghost of his wife, Minnie, appears behind him with a hand on his shoulder. Hague says Jack set the whole thing up, snapping on him. He says it's genius, as Lily begins twitching and emitting electric energy. The lights go out and the power flows between her arms, splitting her head. Gus says the power of Christ compels you, but has his head spun around and killed. June is hanged by her necklace and her throat slit. Haig prays and is in fear, trying to give Lily the check. She says abracadabra and melts Haig's flesh. They try and pull Jack off the stage, and it cuts to a demonic face in the static. Station difficulties until Gus is introducing Jack on stage. Jack is very confused what's going on and how he got here. Gus asks if he's okay until the room goes silent. Jack relives sketches from his show, storming off stage. He's on stage again with his wife, Minnie. Jack yells at the camera to turn off your TV, stop watching this. He remembers signing his contract and the manager saying his greatest sacrifice is yet to come. We see cult members escorting him back as Xandor Diabo tells him great show. He falls to his knees and drinks from the cup. A door opens and is his dying wife, Minnie, in bed. He sits beside her. They told you, you could have it all, didn't they, darling? But you had to pay a price. Jack weeps, saying it wasn't supposed to be this way. He weeps, saying he loves her. She begs him for one last thing as he looks at the ritual dagger. She cries out how much pain she's in, and to do it. Jack grabs a dagger, stabbing her in the gut. Jack screams, realizing he just killed Lily, and sees the carnage on set. Dreamer, here, awake, he chants. But to no success, and the camera cuts to static as the film ends. All right, Brian, what'd you think?
So this ending is where it lost me just a little bit here. Like I mentioned in my open, first off, I don't really have to point out the last instance of Ghost Minnie here since it's not a hidden one at 1 hour and 17 minutes. But yeah, so this ending, like again, the whole electricity aspect of this whole thing is where it lost me some. It's not scary. It seemed very sci-fi channel 1980s, even with the way it was colored. Like I didn't care for the entire cosmetic choice. I think personally we should have gone with no effects, especially electricity wise and whatever portal was being opened on Lily's face. I don't know. But Gus's neck break and June's throat slash I thought were great kills. But I thought Carmichael's was pretty terrible. Like the whole melting thing, I don't know if it really would have looked good or not because the effect was overlaid. The effect that was overlaid on it made it look like really cheesy and bad. So if this was supposed to be – go ahead, nigga.
I'm not going to disagree with you, but I just thought it was a full circle moment with Carmichael's death because there was this moment where he said somebody is like all wax and no wick. So it kind of shows him catching on fire like a candle. I just thought it was a nice touch. But I feel you if you don't like it.
No, I agree that the method of kill was fine. I just meant like the effects of the way it looked. I did not care for that. You know, it was like I mentioned, it was supposed to be real life in the late 70s and not production quality of the 70s. So I didn't really understand the choice of making it look like a melting person from, you know, like a made in a 70s TV show. But anyway, we've been through that. Now, the demonic face and the static, man, I thought that was tremendous. But maybe that should have been where it ended. Like, I mean, not saying that, you know, where it progressed with Jack, you know, almost being in limbo and how the rest of it played out was bad per se. But if you left it up for interpretation or how it ended with just that demonic face and the static and, I don't know, maybe like glitching pictures of the live feed of everybody dead on this stand or on the stage, like it ended up being, I don't know, man. I think that without the electricity effect, of course, I think the ending, man, I think that would have been perfect. But otherwise, man, it does bring the movie down a little bit for me. Oh, and I brought it up before, but when the movie goes from 4:3 ratio to 16.9 or 16:9 aspect ratio after we go off air, I thought again was a nice touch because it's now a third element of change there to depict a different perspective. So I thought that was a very nice choice. That's all.
All right. Again, I love, you know, basically going to replay of the possession scene. And it would have been much easier to do what they're trying to do with today's technology, but to kind of pull it off with the time, you know, the technology of the time, the freeze framing and the blurry and everything. I thought it was really well done, really cool. And it was very effective. I think the line of the power of Christ compels you was a nice little subtle nod there. I think we all know what that is from, but I understand what you're saying, Brian. I do. But I think I was so immersed in the film that I like when when shit got a little crazy right here. Like it really did. Like shit hit the fan, and I think it was really well done. The slit throat, Lily on fire, you know, people melting. I thought all those effects looked pretty good. especially through the lens of that ratio of the 70s there. I thought it was great. And I thought it was really good how the station cut the having difficulties. They switched the camera, which you mentioned. I thought that was a nice touch. And I think going through Jack's memories and his brain, kind of like fourth wrestling mention on the show, but it's almost like his own Firefly Funhouse match, which I think, Dustin, you'll get that reference. That's what I thought of when they're kind of walking back through Jack's life here, ever since he sold his soul anyway. And again, we're kind of seeing what happened to Jack when he sold his soul at the Grove. I thought that was a creepy scene, really well shot, and everything looked so unsettling. The scene with Minnie in the hospital or in the bed, being cut right to him stabbing Lily, and the movie just kind of ending there. I understand the complaint there. I understand that being abrupt. I understand it falling dead. But I do think everything tied back in to the original intro video that we got that was like a news station. I thought it was really well done. It worked for me personally, but I understand the criticism as well. I just thought it was all creepy. It all felt like the same tone. And I know it got a little bit over the top, but the tone never changed to me. I thought it was in the same vein as the rest of the film, in my opinion. So I think job well done. Sometimes you don't always stick the landing. I thought it was pretty good.
So it's very tense stuff when Jack is having them go frame by frame and we see the ghost of his dead wife there, which you guys have mentioned. She's been present more than we've realized up to this point, but I thought that was good stuff. The effects on her, though, I don't know. I didn't love it. A glowy figure, like, it's just kind of cliche and played out to me. Like, it didn't hit. And then Lily buzzing and glitching didn't hit for me. It didn't make any sense. And then suddenly she's Thor, God of Thunder. Like, she can control lightning. And why did her head split? And then why did her head split like that? I don't know. It's just everything that happens after just doesn't really hit for me. Jack has this dream sequence that just, nah. It's just such a shift from the first three quarters of the movie. It didn't hit for me. I will give credit for the look of his wife on her deathbed, though. Like, that's really good makeup and effects on her to make her look like someone who's really on her deathbed from cancer. That was really well done. And then he ended up killing Lily. What? I can't lie. I'm a little confused as fuck, honestly, about the ending. And it's so abrupt. Like, when he comes to and we see that he's killed Lily, at first I thought that he was hypnotized or, maybe, and none of this stuff happened. But we see June, Gus, and Carmichael laid out and how they were actually killed. So it really, all this did happen. I don't know. It just doesn't really make sense for me. Maybe I'm not smart enough to comprehend it, but it was a swing and a miss for me at the end.
All right, not to mansplain or anything. Is it mansplaining if a man's doing it to another man? I don't know. But it said earlier in the film that if you witness these rituals, you will end up doing the act yourself of killing the kids or whatever of Abraxas. Mm-hmm. So it comes full. That's why he kills Lily at the end, because
that's fair.
He saw the rituals.
That's fair. Oh, the whole dream sequence, though. The whole dream sequence. Why?
No, I got you. I got you. Let's jump into our social media comments and questions. I'll knock out Instagram first. Jesse Kraft commented, "I only like the nostalgia factor of this one, and that's it. Storyline was eh. They really did nail the 70s talk show vibe, though. That was spot on. Really interested to know your guys' thoughts on it." Jen and Juice commented, "Very clever film. I went into it thinking it would be overhyped, but it exceeded my creepy expectations." So we're 50-50 on the guests or the comments so far.
Sipping on gin and juice.
Hey, that's a song by Snoop Dogg, I know. Danny C-Naps commented, "I was pretty disappointed with this one. There was so much hype, and when I finally watched it, I was left with a, that was it, feeling. Really looking forward to In a Violent Nature and Long Legs, so I'm hoping those aren't duds. I'm going to go see In a Violent Nature next week when it drops. I'm excited for that one as well." Queen is Elizabeth 717 commented, "First off, great selection, Nika. I appreciate that. I appreciate the originality of this film. I like that there was no megastar in this where it takes you out of the film. The camera work, costumes, cinematography really made me feel in the 1970s. My question is, was a tall tree supposed to come into play later and then it got scratched? They brought it up with what I thought significant that I thought it would tie together in the end." Sorry, I butchered that. "Love your guys' work as always." I think they tied the tall tree thing in once.
Yeah, like I said on our reaction, it didn't hit for me, but once I watched it again and I saw that, like, it made a lot of sense.
That's what I tell everybody. It's like, you got to watch that beginning stuff. You got to pay attention to it, because all that stuff they talk about comes full circle later on. We only got two more comments. Amanda Please 84 commented, after seeing the reviews, I expected to love it, but it was just okay for me. I understand. Mm-hmm. Jordan Ziegler commented, I'm excited to hear what you guys think, because I don't know how I feel about this movie still, with a laughing emoji. On the first watch, everything felt chaotic and all over the place, but maybe I just need to rewatch it, LOL. I commented back, I think it's a two-watch minimum, in my opinion, because a lot happens. And she replied, I didn't watch any trailers or anything for it either, so I guess so much happened, and I was left feeling like, what the hell was this movie even about? But not in a bad way, necessarily, LOL. All right, Brian, you want to go next with The Book of Faces?
The Book of Faces. Yeah, by the way, have you seen that Office? No, you don't watch The Office. I was going to say, that reminds me of the Halloween Office episode where he's Facebook and he just has like a book on his face or something. That's fucking awesome. Dad joke century. Anyway, Jennifer Tyree said, this was actually a great movie, explanation point. That was three explanation points. I just wanted you to realize that. I was really excited. I was skeptical, but TikTok sold me on it, so I watched it. Totally worth a watch. The damn Tic Tacs. Man, always making some influential decisions. Anita Russell, I like this movie a lot, but no other way to describe it but weird. Get you wholeheartedly on that one. Cole McAlexander, not going to lie, this was a really hard movie for me to follow when I watched it. Going to have to take a closer look during the rewatch. Keep up the great work, fellas. Thank you, Cole. And yeah, that seems to be a running trend with comments about it's kind of hard to keep up with a little bit. And I get that. And like Nico said, subsequent rewatches are definitely needed.
Yeah. So I'll do X, the artist formerly known as Twitter now. First of all, before I do that, Brian, good call. Good deep cut there, bringing up Jim's costume as Facebook. He just wrote B.O. Nice. On one side of his nose, OK on the other side of his nose, so he's Facebook.
There we go. That's what it was.
It's from season 6 of The Office. I just had to look up what episode that was, because I did remember it. But anyway, from X, we have a few comments here. Fraser Rice said, enjoyed this movie. Short, to the point, succinct, nice. That guy, at Millhouse14108, this one kind of made me laugh. Really enjoyed this film. Did a great job making you feel like you were living in 70s late night. Fresh idea mixed with great acting proved to make a quality movie. I bet Dustin hates on Nico's pick, as per usual. Ah, come on. That's not always true. he said, 8 out of 10 for me. Cheers. And then he followed it up, said, how I see the review from Dustin coming, and it's a gif of soft serve that looks like diarrhea. So that was funny. Yeah. And then he said, I watched it live. Oh, I told him he should check out the instant reaction. He said, I watched it live, and I know you're on board with this movie, but listening to you and Nico agree on something is like watching the Seminoles and Gators team up. Shit just isn't right. So I thought that was funny.
God damn.
Troy Ray said, this movie does a great job of creating the look and feel of an old late-night talk show. I'm just not sure what it's about. And then some asshole named Nico commented, cinema.
Attaboy. Attaboy, Nico.
All right, y'all want to knock out fun facts real quick? Brian, yeah, you want to go first? I got a few, but if
I said on mine,
Dustin, brother. Go ahead. I'll go after you. If you say any of mine, I'll just cut them.
All right, so my standard spiel about if any of these were said during the episode, I apologize, Brian. Just cut them out, make it look like it didn't happen. But in 2024 interview with the Movable Fest, Colin Carnes explained that the reason the film is set in 77 was the film had to happen on a Monday night for Sweeps Week. So the stakes are high, and this was the beginning of the week. It's going to make or break Jack Delroy's career, right? And it just so happened that 1977 was the only year of the 70s where Halloween fell on a Monday night. So we thought 77, that's pretty much, you're right in the thick of it. So that worked for us. This is a controversial one, which I'm sure, Nico, you'll probably touch on it more, or your opinion on it anyway. The cutaways and the "we'll be right back" network messages were made with AI. Doesn't bother me. One of the first commercial breaks right before they bring out Carmichael, Jack states, he's all whack, no wicks. You touched on that, Nico. This is right before his character is introduced and foreshadows the end scene where Carmichael is set on fire or burned from the inside by Lily. And then the last one I've got is when Gus is talking to Carmichael before being hypnotized, he mentions wanting to keep his head between his shoulders. And Carmichael promises to make it spin, which foreshadows Gus's death as he is killed when Lily twists his head around, breaking his neck.
All right, I only got a couple.
Famed horror novelist Stephen King has praised the movie. He said, "I got a screener. It's absolutely brilliant. I couldn't take my eyes off of it. Your results may vary, as they say, but I urge you to watch it when you can." Shout out to Stephen King, that weirdo. But he's a brilliant guy, too. Ian Bliss. This fun fact and another one, the next one I have after it, is super impressive to me. Ian Bliss, who played Carmichael Haig, was originally hired to play another character after he was originally hired to be a cast reader. Bliss had just 4 days to prepare for the role of Haig as the original actor withdrew at the last minute. He killed his role, so I think that's pretty damn impressive how good he was. And I heard this next fun fact on the David Dasmalchian interview on Scream Dreams podcast. The June Ross Mitchell's actress, Laura Gordon, was supposed to portray his wife. However, the hired actor, the actress to play the parapsychologist, did not get the COVID vaccine and she could not go into Australia. So they asked her to take over the role the Thursday before the Monday. So she learned how to play June Ross Mitchell on Thursday to Monday. I think that's incredibly impressive. Those two actors, actresses learned their roles in such a short time. And they both killed it. So good job for them. Mike Moneyman.
Absolutely. So this movie was made for around $2 million, super low budget. And then that opening weekend had a very limited theater release. So if it did play near you, you should feel blessed if you got to go see it because it wasn't in a lot of theaters. And it was only in certain locations, especially. Yep. And I know Nico got to. I know Dustin got to. So that's awesome. But again, it wasn't playing a lot of places around the country. So I'm glad that you guys got to get out there. I mean, it was an IFC / Shudder release, and those movies don't typically get a big time release. But opening weekend-wise was the biggest IFC movie release of all time as far as theaters go from their studio. $2.8 million on opening weekend with very limited marketing, very limited release. I think that really was a strong showing. And again, blew everything that studio had been putting out of the water. So, you know, made its money back and then some. And I thought it was great, man. I mean, it was a great sign for horror, at least, that a movie with not that much marketing until that, like, week leading up when I started seeing some of the clips. I think it did a really good job. So, and no. Fun fact that everyone thought was true, it did not make $6,666.66 or whatever the opening night. That's not true. That was a false fact that I thought was a fun little bit of marketing.
Yeah, I was thinking about that. That is fun, though. All right, guys, jump into our favorite kill, least favorite kill in the rating. Who wants to kick us off?
I'll do it. My favorite kill is June. Getting choked out by your necklace is gnarly, and it came with a nice throat slice. I thought the effects looked pretty good. Least favorite for me was, like I said, Christo. It was off screen, completely unnecessary in the grand scheme of things, just didn't hit for me. As far as my final thoughts and the ratings, I really liked the majority of this movie, but the ending missed so badly for me. It's an easy watch with a great runtime, which I know Mike appreciated. Great acting, they nail the era, but I just can't justify giving it over 7.25.
All right, my favorite kill is June Ross Mitchell. I was caught very off guard when she suddenly lifted into the air and had her throat slit. I think most of the ending kills are good, though. My worst, I agree with you, Dustin, is Christu off screen. And I thought he was a cool character. I wish we got more of him in the movie. But I think he was killed because he came on Jack's sweeps week. And everything involved with him was going to suffer to support him that because of the deal he made with the devil.
Didn't die.
Some of them might have.
Maybe.
Nah, I don't know. We didn't see everybody, but... Yeah, I feel you though. All right, I just wrote a little paragraph. This is easily one of my favorite recent horror movies. And just overall, this instantly has become a comfort movie I can turn on anytime and a part of my Halloween rotation. Seeing this in theaters was an incredible experience. One of the few horror movies I went in and saw twice on the big screen. The vintage look of the film and setting makes you feel like you're in the studio audience. Every single character, actor gave great performances. I saw a comment, you know, this is actually from Queen is Elizabeth. I knew I saw a comment online where the film worked for them because there weren't any big names and everyone worked well together. And I agree 100%. Hottest of hot takes. Ingrid Torelli gives the best possessed child performance I've ever seen. Her cadence and demeanor was phenomenal. David and Reese could host a late night show right now. They were both so good. This film touches on the willingness to do whatever it takes to become famous and successful. And I really appreciated it. This film took a couple watches for me to understand everything because it is easy to miss things at the theater, but I love this movie more and more with each watch. I love how everything from the beginning and little comments come full circle with our subject, Jack Delroy. The subtle details of voices changing to sound like Minnie and her image appearing throughout Hidden are chef's kiss. We on this show have begged for more original content and stories, and Late Night with the Devil delivered. But what I love most about this movie is I saw it during a really tough time of my life, and it gave me a break from reality. I gave the movie a 10.
Whoa. Hey, all right, brother. That's what I'm talking about. Say it with your chest, man. Now, my favorite kill was Judy, and my least favorite one was Christo because it was off screen, and I felt like there should have been a little bit more impact on that for sure. I agree with you, Dustin, on that one. Look, said everything I needed to say. Love the way this movie looks. That makes up the majority of the score, to be honest, because it immersed me in the film just by nailing that part of it. And then I love the talk show stuff. Sorry, it's not. Hey, man, June, my bad. Sorry, everyone. June, not Judy. Jesus Christ. Same fucking syllables. Anyway.
Actually, it's not. June.
All right.
It's not. Judy is two syllables.
I know, motherfucker.
June is one syllable.
Not the way I say it. June. There you go. Two. Anyway. Okay. June, my favorite death. Christo is my least favorite. All right. So, said everything I had to say. Really loved the aesthetic of the movie and makes up the majority of the score for me personally. And then I love the stuff with the talk show. You feel like you're on one of those late night talk shows. And I think they nail. Man, the effects don't bother me. I think they nailed the creepy aspects of this movie. It felt like I was watching a real news special that went awry, that went really, really wrong. And I love that aspect of it. So all the great things I've said about it, nothing really negative to write home about. It's just hard to get a 10 out of me. So I'm not going to give this movie a 10. I'm going to give this movie a 9.
Okay. My least favorite death, Melting Carmichael. Again, not the actual death. It was just the way that it looked. I didn't care for it. My favorite death, I'm going to go with Sheriff Judy from Scream as well. The throat slash I thought was great. Oh, my bad. June.
Hey, motherfucker. In case you want to know, I've got June written in my notes, you dick. I just said Judy on accident. Fuck.
Anyway, look, this movie is really good on first watch. The ending brought it down for me some, like I mentioned. Like Nico mentioned, though, I really do love the uniqueness of this movie. I thought it was very well done. Like Dustin, so I'm being super unoriginal. I'll give it also a 7.25 out of 10.
June, right there, pal. June, yeah, in the words,
we
asshole.
We don't care what you just changed. It's all good.
Fuck you. That I said June in the review. Go back and listen.
I have the talking pillow. That gives us a composite score of an 8.385. IMDb has it at a 7.1. Or, I'm sorry, 8.375. IMDb has it at a 7.1. Rotten Tomatoes, it's sitting at 97%. So that's kind of funny. We're right in between IMDb and Rotten Tomatoes.
Rotten Tomatoes knows ball. All right, I'll shout out our blood donors, and Dustin, you can announce your pick for next week. We really appreciate our blood donors. Y'all take a big burden off of us. It means a lot to us. Anita Russell, final girl donor, shout out to her. She picked a really good movie, Primal Fear. That's a good-ass movie. That's from the 90s, Brian. I know you haven't seen it. It's a great movie.
90s is overrated.
Are you kidding me? He had a mortgage in the 90s.
God damn it.
He had a 401k and everything. All right, Camper Level Reoccurring, Nina, Michelle Mirza, the Horror Movie Crew Podcast, Alex Elgson, and Michael Evans. Camp Counselor Reoccurring, Edwin Hernandez Gunn, Joe Swinford, Shan, Adrian Aiello, Brian Samick, Andrew Ferguson, Matt Strickland, Brooke Maley, Thorne David Phillips, Heather Superdoc, Jennifer Davis from the Too Close to Home Pod, Dana Tucker, and my guy, Cole McAlexander. We really appreciate y'all. Yeah, it means a lot to us. It does take a big burden off us, helping us pay these bills. Dustin, announce your pick for next week, and we end our freestyle month.
I got to be honest with you. I forgot that it was my pick, and I forgot what I picked. But upon further review, I picked a movie that holds a lot of nostalgia for me. I just remember watching this movie as a kid with my dad, and just like I loved it. He didn't really like it, but anytime it was on, I'd make him stop the TV and let's watch it. I went with 1986's Stephen King adaptation, Maximum Overdrive. That's right. Emilio! That's from
Mike is Rockstar disgusted. Nico. I've never seen it, so I didn't know.
God damn it.
I know. That's why I was telling you. But it also has Yardley Smith, who you may know better as Lisa fucking Simpson. She's in the movie, so that's cool.
I don't watch The Simpsons. I'm not a kid.
No.
But you know who that is.
That's an adult cartoon, you dick.
I'm just being an asshole because you guys are mean to me. I'm fighting back.
Just for picking Maximum Overdrive, you can suck my Judy's, pal.
Hey, Mike. Hey, what? Mike. What does Megan stand for in the movie Megan?
Dude, I have it in my little notes here.
No, I know. I don't want you to have it in your notes.
Oh,
what is it? You don't remember?
No.
Oh, okay.
Model 3 generative
Android.
All right. I don't know how we got on this tangent.
What about the ship and Alien?
I didn't get that one right.
I'm just asking if you remember from the quiz.
No.
Also,
Nostromo or something like that.
There you go.
I got my answers to the quiz if you want.
Also, I've been wanting to pick Maximum Overdrive. This movie is overdue for me to pick because I bought this movie, the Steelbook, like last year. I was like, okay, as soon as I receive it in, we're doing that movie, and I just kicked the can down the road, so we're finally doing it. That's why I had to pick it this time.
My answer to that question, Brian, was the Titanic, so you're welcome.
You're right.
Go listen to the quiz.
All right, we appreciate y'all tuning in. This was fun. I really appreciate you guys reviewing Late Night with the Devil with me. Overdue, in my opinion. Shout out to Mike. Great film. Give us more original content. And shout out to Shudder and IFC, man. I think they're doing really good this year. I think Late Night with Devil is great. I'm really excited for In a Violent Nature, which I'm sure most of us will go see in the theaters. We'll do an instant reaction. I'm excited for that.
Yeah, man, I'm all
POV slasher movie. I'm here for it. I'm excited to see that one. So, yeah, we thank y'all for tuning in and comment what you thought about Late Night with the Devil. Y'all have a good one. Just want to remind everybody.
You know when you're listening to a true crime story that has an unbelievable plot twist that makes you stop in your tracks? That's what our podcast, People Are the Worst, brings you with each episode. I'm Rachel.
And I'm Rebecca. We're identical twins who love true crime cases that make you say, "Didn't see that coming," and we hate the people responsible for them. Listen to People Are the Worst now on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.